Chapter 13. Shima. What frightens me when I travel is not that so many men possess customs and creeds so different from my own. Nay, what frightens me is that they think them as natural and as obvious as I think my own. Seratantis III, Sumni Meditations. A return to a place never seen. Always it is thus when we understand what we cannot speak. Protathus, 100 Heavens. Spring, 4112, Year of the Tusk, at Yersus. Shouts of consternation drew Nocera to the unshuttered colonnade that adjoined the rudiments library, high above the western ramparts of at Yersus, where students often gathered on mild and sunny days. Several young initiates stared and pointed across the dark straits, along with Marmion, an auditor on furlough from their mission in Oswenta. Nocera waved them away, leaned out over the stone balustrade. As tired as his eyes were, he could see the cause of the commotion quite clearly. 15 yellow-painted galleys anchoring in the straits, poised across the cerulean blue less than a mile from the mouth of Atyrsus's scarped harbor. Distant seamen climbed the rigging, lowering beams on sails adorned with tusks, long and vertical and golden. Atyrsus was thrown into an uproar. Initiates and officers bawled commands. The fortress's soldiery stamped down the narrow corridors, rushing to man far-flung walls and turrets. Nocera joined the other members of the quorum on the heights of the Comoranth Tower, where they could view the fleet of interlopers without obstruction. They made a ludicrous sight. 7 old men, 2 in nightshirts, 1 still wearing an ink-stained scriptor's apron, and the rest, like Nocera, in full ceremonial garb, waving liver-spotted hands as they bickered back and forth. Most of them assumed the obvious, that the ships were part of a blockade meant to prevent their imminent departure for Shima. But just who were they? The colors and tusks suggested the Thousand Temples. Did the Shrial ingrates think themselves a match for the Gnosis? Simis counseled immediate attack. "As far as we know," he cried, "the second apocalypse has already begun. No matter who owns the deed to these galleys, we can only assume that the consult commands them. We've always known they would attempt to destroy us in the opening days, and now, with a harbinger, this so-called warrior prophet, think, my brothers, what would the consult do? Wouldn't they risk anything to prevent us from joining the holy war? We must strike!" But Nocera wasn't so rash. "To act in ignorance," he fairly screeched, "is always folly, whether at war or not." Ultimately, however, word that a launch rowed toward shore settled the matter. Despite his protestations, Simis was overruled. The quorum agreed they should at least treat with the strangers. Slaves hastened to make ready their litters, and soon Nocera was staring at the mysterious vessels through the veils of his palanquin. The slaves fairly ran down the switchback road, running from Atyrsus's main gate to the stone quays that jutted into the fortress's small natural harbor. Surrounded by confused throngs of guards and adepts, the quorum assembled on the ancient stone of the one jetty not crowded with berthed ships. The launch had drawn near enough for them to cluck in astonishment. They traded rapid conjectures, but it was clear that no one knew what was happening. Their voices trailed as the dockmen caught the ropes thrown from the approaching launch. The rowers pulled their oars skyward. The boat was pulled in and secured. Nocera and the others stood rigid with shock. Complete silence fell across the surrounding copse of masts and rigging. The Enroni seamen crowding the railings of the neighboring ships stared down in wonder, not only at their sorcerous masters, but at the retinue that climbed from the launch. The quorum stood, 7 old, scowling men, watching as their visitors assembled on the tip of the finger of stone. Expressionless, their silvered helms and chain bright in the sun, 5 Shrial knights formed a wordless line, screening the figures behind. Their koray murmured dark beneath their white silk surcoats. Of those behind, Nocera could only glimpse faces, most of them clean-shaven. Then an imposing black-bearded figure pressed past the knights into the quorum's astonished view. With the exception of Nocera, he loomed over all of them, dressed in a stately gown of white that had been hemmed about the collar and sleeves with golden tusks the size of finger bones. Though his face seemed middle-aged, his blue eyes were surprisingly young. He, too, wore a kore against his breast. "Holy Shrya," Nocera said evenly. "Mathanet? Here?" Smiling with radiant warmth, the man studied their faces, raised his eyes to the dark bastions of Atyrsus behind them. He lunged forward. And somehow, his movement had been too quick for surprised eyes to comprehend. He was holding Simus by the base of the skull. The air was riven with sorcerous muttering. Eyes flared with Gnostic light. Wards whisked into shimmering existence. Almost as one, the members of the quorum fell into defensive posture. Dust and grit trailed down the sloped sides of the jetty. Simus had gone limp as a kitten, his white-haired head lolling against the fist bunched at the back of his neck. The Shrya seemed to hold him with impossible strength. "Release him!" Yetiskeres cried, scrambling back with the others. Mathanet spoke as though showing them how to slaughter rabbits. "If you pinch them here," he said, jerking the old man as if in emphasis, "they are thoroughly incapacitated."
Release him!
"What's this madness?" Nocera exclaimed. He alone hadn't cast any wards. Neither had he retreated down the jetty with the others. In fact, he stepped between the Shrya and his fellow schoolmen, as though interposing himself to protect the man. "And if you wait," Mathanet continued, now staring directly at Nocera, "if you wait, their true aspect will be revealed." The old sorcerer struggled for his breath. There was something about the way Simus shook, something not old, something not—
"He's killing his—"
"Silence!"
Nocera shouted. "We learned of this one through our interrogations of the others," Mathanet said, his voice possessing a resonance that brushed aside the alarmed prattle. "It's an accident, an anomaly that thankfully its architects have been unable to recreate." "It?"
"What are you saying?"
Nocera cried. Thrashing slack limbs, the thing called Simus began howling in 100 lunatic voices. Mathanet braced his feet, rocked like a fisherman holding a twisting shark. Nocera stumbled back, his hands raised in warding. With abject horror, he watched the man's oh-so-familiar face crack open, clutch at the skies with hooked digits. "A skin spy with the ability to work sorcery," the Shrya of the Thousand Temples said, grimacing with exertion. "A skin spy with a soul." And the grand old sorcerer realized he had known all along. Spring, 4112, Year of the Tusk, Shima. Ecstatic shouts rang out over the whisk and thud of galloping horsemen. Someone let go a long, low whistle. Proyas reined his horse to a halt at the fore of his household knights. His face, blank in the manner of knotted stomachs, he stared dumbstruck at the eastern horizon. At first, he struggled with a dismaying sense of banality. For days now, he'd known this vista lay just beyond the horizon. Unseen, it had seemed something at once dark and golden, a monument so terrible with holiness that he could do naught but fall on his belly when confronted by its aspect. But now, he felt no urge to fall. In fact, he felt no urge to do anything whatsoever, save to breathe and to watch. When he glanced at his fellow men of the Tusk, they seemed little more than brigands appraising a victim, or wolves watching the herd that would fatten them for winters to come. He found himself wondering if this was always the way when dreams confronted the actuality that conceived them. He felt the customary wonder of sighting a great city from a great distance, he supposed, the sense of standing far from the carnival of brick and humanity that would soon encompass him, nothing more. The tears struck before the passion. He tasted them first. When he reached up to wipe his lips, the length and thickness of his beard surprised his hand. Where was Zynemus? He'd promised to describe. His shoulders hitched in silent sobs. Sky and city reeled through broken sunlight. He clutched tight his saddle's iron pommel. He thumbed the frayed knots that secured his canteen. Finally, he cleared his throat, blinked, and looked about. He heard and saw other men weeping. He sighted a sunburned man farther down the line of accumulating in Rethi, kneeling shirtless in the grasses with his arms thrown wide, screaming at the city, as though confessing hatred to a tyrannical father.
"Sweet God of gods,"
someone behind Proyas began intoning,
"who walk among us? Innumerable are your hallowed names."
The words swelled with deep-throated resonance, became ever more implacable and embalming as horseman after horseman took them up. Soon the slopes thrummed with cracked voices. They were the faithful, come with arms to undo long centuries of wickedness. They were the men of the Tusk, bereaved and heartbroken, laying eyes on the ground of countless fatal oaths. How many brothers, how many fathers and sons?
"May your bread silence our daily hunger."
Proyas joined them in their prayer, even as he grasped the reason for his turmoil. They were the swords of the warrior prophet, he realized, and this was the city of Inri Sejanus. Moves had been made, and rules had been changed. Kellis and the circumfiction had hamstrung all the old points and purposes. So here they stood, signatories to an obsolete indenture, celebrating a destination that had become a way station. And no one knew what it meant.
"Judge us not according to our trespasses,
Shima,
but according to our temptations,
Shima at long last. If she was not holy before, Proyas decided, Zynemus and all the uncounted dead had made her such. There was no working back from what was final. The Ainani of Mozarothu stood scattered across the shallow heights, watching their palatine, the hard-hearted Uranyanka, lead the warrior prophet to the best vantage. The two men paused beside a wall so ancient that grasses thronged along its broken crest, one of several ruined mausoleums set across the hillside. Before them stretched the plains of Sherazor, still blackened from the recent burning of fields and plantations. The river Jeshimal bisected the distances, winding like a rope into the violet and mauve foothills of the Betmula Mountains. A great city occupied the heart of the plain, gathered about a pair of promontories overlooking the Menenor. Her curtain walls, which had been tiled in white, gleamed in the sunlight. Great eyes, each as tall as a tree, marred their circuit and seemed to stare back at them. Shima, the sacred city of the latter prophet, at long last. Some fell to their knees, bawling like children, but most simply stared, their faces blank. Names were like baskets. Usually they came to men already filled, with refuse, banalities, and valuables mixed in various measures. But sometimes the passage of events overthrew them. Sometimes they came to bear different burdens, heavier things, darker things. Shima was such a name. From the four corners of Eärwa, they had come. They had hungered about the walls of Momim. They had survived the great bloodlettings of Mengeda and Anwarat. They had cleansed Shigek with their fury, walked the furnace plains of the great Carathay. They had endured pestilence, starvation, and insurrection. They had nearly murdered the god's own prophet. Now, at last, they apprehended the purpose of their heartbreaking labor. For the pious and the sentimental, this was a moment of consummation. But for those scarred by their innumerable trials, this could only be a time of measure. What could be worth what they had suffered? What could repay what they had exacted? This place? This chalk-white city? Shima? Somewhere, somehow, the name had been overturned. But as always, the words of the warrior prophet circulated among them. "This," he was said to have said, "is not your destination. It's your destiny." Parties of knights struck across the plain while more and more men of the Tusk crowded the hillside. Soon the entire Holy War stood arrayed along the summits, staring and pointing. There, to the south, was the shrine of Azaroa, where Inri Sejanus had given the first of his sermons, and there was the High Round, the great fortress raised by Triamarius II, its black concentric walls overlooking the Menenor. And to its right, with its ochre stone and cyclopean pillars, was the Mokal Palace, the ancient seat of the Amati kings. And that line, running from the hills to the city across the Sherazor Plain, marked the remnants of the Skelurin Aqueduct, named after the most gluttonous of Amotu's Nansur rulers. And there, on the Jutaram, the holy heights, stood the first temple, the great circular gallery of columns that marked the site of the latter prophet's ascension. And to its right, with a gold-flaring dome above a facade of stacked colonnades, was the dread Tesseract, the cancer they had come to excise, the great tabernacle of the Kishorim. Only as the sun drew their shadows to the footings of the many-eyed walls did they abandon the hillsides to strike camp on the plain below. Few slept that night, such was their confusion, such was their wonder. Spring 4112, Year of the Tusk, Amotu.
"Every Biaxi breathing," the exalt general, the emperor, had said, "I shall burn you all alive."
General Biaxi Sampas found himself obsessing over these words. Would he do such a thing? The answer to that question was obvious. Akuri Confis was capable of anything. One need only spend a day in his company to know that. And there was always Martimus to remember. But could he? That was the question. Old Zorias would never dare. He understood, even respected, the power of House Biaxi. There would be uproar in the houses of the congregate, even insurrection. If one house could be scratched from the lines, then any house could be. Besides, the Icuris had enough enemies as it was. Confis wouldn't dare. But he would. Sampas could feel it in his bones. Confis would dare. And what was more, the other houses would simply stand by and watch. Who would raise arms against the Lion of Cayuth? Sweet Sejanus, the army had chosen him over a prophet. No, no, he did the right thing, the only thing he could do, under the circumstances.
"We've come too far east,"
Captain Agnaris said in his dour, matter-of-fact way.
"Of course, you idiot, that's the idea."
They had been fleeing for several days now. Himself, his captain, his sorcerer, and some 11 other Kidrahil. They still called it hunting, but with a possible exception of the Sake schoolmen, they knew. They were being hunted. He could no longer remember the last contact they'd had with any of the other parties, though he knew others had to be out there, somewhere. They still rode across the wrinkled feet of the Betmula, though the forests had become temple-deep, almost reminiscent of those beneath the Hethanta Mountains. The sun had drawn low on the western horizon, its warmth and light baffled by the soaring canopy. Their horses trod across soft and uneven humus. The deepening shadows seemed to whine with horror. He had panicked. He realized that now. He'd felt the Skilvendi slipping away, so he'd divided his search parties into even smaller units, telling himself he needed a finer net. That was when things began falling apart, when the trail they followed became strewn with Kidrahil, dead and desecrated. Riders were dispatched to muster the scattered parties, never to return. The sense of dread had grown, like a rash made gangrenous from scratching. Then one morning, Sampas could no longer remember which. They had woken up fugitives. But how could he have known? No, no, demons hadn't been part of the bargain, sake or no sake.
"We've come too far,"
the weather-beaten captain repeated, peering through the darkness that bloated through the towering cedars.
"The Holy War must be near, either them or the Fainim."
According to Agnaris, they had passed out of Zarash some time ago.
"Holy Amotu," he found himself thinking, "the sacred land."
His men pretended not to notice his strange laugh. Oris, however, snorted in disgust. The schoolman, one of those sallow, impudent types, had stopped disguising his contempt several days ago. He pressed on, though he could sense their growing impatience. Swaying to the pitch of their saddles, they passed between the great low forking trunks, riding in loose formation. Cones crunched beneath hooves, resin bittered the air. The sun fell, and with every passing moment, the depths of the forest became less distinct, as though black gauze had been strung between the trees. This, Sampas decided, had to be the forest of Hebana, as it was called in the days of the tractate. But since temple, for him, had been little more than an excuse to carouse and politic, he remembered little of what the scripture had to say of the place. Without warning and quite without permission, Captain Agnaris called a halt. They had come to a clearing of sorts, a broad expanse beneath the bowers of an ancient cedar more massive than any the general had ever seen. Weary and wordless, his cavalrymen dismounted and set about their assigned tasks. Not one dared look at him. The horses were attended to, the fires kindled, and the tents pitched. Soon the darkness was near absolute, and smoke pillared the clearing, winding high into the heart of the sheltering cedar. Sitting upon one of the humped roots, the general could only watch, idly pinching the hem of his blue mantle. Very little was said. When the sorcerer slipped away to relieve himself, Sampas found himself joining him. He was not quite willing things to happen anymore. They just happened.
I have no choice.
They stood, side by side, amid some scrub just outside the circle of firelight.
This has been a disaster,
the schoolman snapped, watching him in the indirect way of urinating men.
An absolute disaster. You can be assured, General, that all this will find its way to official parch.
It had quite possessed a soul of its own, rising and falling with nary a glimmer. Such a naughty knife. Sampas cleaned it on the twitching man's leggings, then joined his men his glorious Kidrahil about the fire. Them he could trust to understand. Enough of them, anyway. But a sorcerer? Please. He had no choice. It simply had to happen. It wasn't just his own skin at stake. It was his entire line. He couldn't allow his ill fortune, for it was nothing more, to blot out all of House Biaxi. Confis would do it, without scruple or compunction. His only hope, Sampas had realized, was to see him dead. His only hope was to find the holy war, to throw himself on the mercy of the warrior prophet, to let him know. And who knew? Were the accursed Icuri wiped out? Perhaps a Biaxi might find his way to the mantle. An emperor conspiring against his faith with the Fainim? The more Sampas had considered it, the more it seemed that honor and righteousness bound him to this course. He had no choice. Surprised at his own calm, Sampas joined Agnaris, who sat alone at the officer's fire. The man seemed to work hard not to look at him.
Where's Oris?
Sampas asked, as though annoyed at a generally acknowledged fool.
Who knows?
The captain replied.
In the woods, shitting.
Who cares? His tone said. There was relief in that. Sitting on his camp stool, the general clutched his hands together before the flames, lest the hard-boiled soldiers see them shake. Agnaris was a threesy in the classic mold. He understood weakness, which was far more dangerous than simply holding it in contempt, for Sampas anyway. The general glanced at the other, larger fire, where the others congregated, and a number of looks clicked instantly away. They were too silent, and their faces, etched in the kindling firelight, were far too blank. Suddenly, he could feel it. They were waiting for an opportunity to cut his throat. Sampas returned his gaze to the fire, thought of Oris lying crumpled in the undergrowth mere lengths away. He would have to pick his moment carefully, and his words. Or perhaps he should just slip away.
Who guards the perimeter?
He asked Agnaris, making his decision even as he spoke.
Yes, yes, slip away. Run, run.
Shouts brought him and Agnaris to their feet.
There's something in the I hear it!
Shut up!
The captain roared.
All of you!
He held his hands out to either side, as though literally holding their voices down. The fire seemed to cackle. A coal popped. Sampas jumped. Weapons drawn, they stood listening for a dreadful moment, peering into the canopy, but seeing only the limbs that raftered air immediately above them, those painted by firelight. The smoke seemed to roll up into oblivion. Then they heard it, a rasp from the blackness above. There was a small rain of grit. Then bark twirled across the clearing.
Sweet Sejanus!
One of the cavalrymen gasped, only to be silenced by barks of anger. There was a sound like that of a little boy pissing across leather. A sizzling hiss drew their attention to the main fire. It seemed all their eyes focused upon it at once, a thread of blood unwinding across the flames, followed by a plummeting shadow. Fiery wood and coals exploded outward. Smoke billowed. Men cried out in the sudden twilight, stumbled back. Some frantically beat at sparks on cloaks and clothing. Sampas could only stare at Oris, bent backward over the heaped fire, broken and bleeding. The horses screamed and reared beneath the trees, little more than dancing shadows in the greater black. Agnaris bawled out orders, but she had already dropped into their midst, falling like rope. All Sampas could do was stagger backward. He had no choice. The captain fell first, tripping to his knees, coughing, gagging, as if trying to dislodge a chicken bone. Two more followed, clutching wounds that glittered black. Sampas could scarce see her long sword, it moved so fast. Blonde hair whisked like silk in the gloom, chasing a pale face of impossible beauty. And the general realized he recognized her. The Prince of Atrathal's woman, the one whose corpse had been hung with a man in Karaskand. She had come down from her tree. The Kidrahil retreated before her whirling figure, flailing with their blades. She leapt after them, catching a man's throat like an orange on the tip of her sword. Howling out of the darkness, the Skilvendi barreled into their flank, hewing them with great, sweeping strokes. Men fell in gouts. Then it was over. Save for a gagging that might have been a shriek. Shirtless, slicked in sweat, the Skilvendi turned to him and spat, a thing of scars and cuts that would be scars. Despite his prodigious size, he seemed scarecrow thin, like something starved of far more than food. His eyes glinted from beneath his battered brow. His stance wide, the barbarian stood before Sampas while the beautiful woman circled behind. From nowhere, it seemed, a third figure leapt from the blackness beyond the fires, landing in a crouch to the Skilvendi's left, a man Sampas did not recognize. A shudder seized the Nansor general, and he found himself absurdly thankful he had relieved his bladder just moments earlier. He hadn't even drawn his sword.
"She saw you murder the other,"
the Skilvendi said, wiping spattered blood into a smear across his cheek.
"Now she wants to fuck."
A warm hand snaked along the back of his neck, pressed against his cheek. That night, Biaxi Sampas learned that there were rules for everything, including what could and could not happen to one's own body. These, he discovered, were the most sacred rules of all. Once, in the screaming, snarling misery of it all, he thought of his wives and children burning, but only once. Spring, 4112, Year of the Tusk, Shima. In the dawning light, the judges led great trains of the faithful to bathe in the river Jeshimal. Many beat their own backs with branches, an impromptu rite of penance. Parties of mounted knights watched over the worshippers, wary of marauders from the city, whose white turrets loomed in the near distance. But the black gates remained shut, and no heathen dared molest them. Their hair wet and their eyes bright, most returned to the encampment singing, certain they had been cleansed. But some were unnerved, for the many-eyed walls seemed to mock them. The Tatokar walls, they called them, though few knew the significance of the name. Along with Kayudia, her ruined sister to the northwest, Shima had been the ancestral seat of the Amadi kings. In the time of Inri Sejanus, the city was far smaller, encompassing only the heights to the east of the Jeshimal. By the time Triamus I declared Inrithism the official faith of the Canaan Empire, the city had doubled in size, swollen by the influx of pilgrims and markets. But unlike Karaskand, which was at once a strategic caravan entrepot and exposed to the unruly tribes of the Karathay, the Aspect Emperors saw no need to raise walls about the greater city. After all, the entire Three Seas lay under Kanae's heavy but prosperous hand. Even in the turbulent days following the Empire's collapse, during Omotu's brief and contentious independence, no defenses, save the heterine wall about the sacred heights, were constructed. It was Sermantes Atancius I, the warlike Nansor Emperor, famous for his endless wars against Nilnamesh, who first walled the outer city, taking ancient representations of Metsonk's many-towered fortifications as his model. The white glazed tile was added centuries later by the Kishorim under Tatokar I. Apparently, the High Heresiarch disapproved of Zetantius's quarries. The towering eyes were the responsibility of Tatokar's successor, the famed poet Hakti Ab-Saban. When a visiting Ainani dignitary asked him for an explanation, he reportedly said they were to remind the idolaters that the solitary god does not blink. To shame them, in effect. Even then, the silting of Shima's harbor had forced Enrithi pilgrims to enter the city via her gates. Origins aside, the eyes became the subject of ceaseless debate among the men of the Tusk. Sometimes they seemed to gaze with bland curiosity, and at others to glare in a kind of entranced fury. The longer the Enrithi pondered them, the more Shima took on the aura of a living thing, until she seemed some great and unfathomable beast, like a vast ramshackle crab sunning on shore after crawling up from the deep. It made the prospect of assaulting the city uncertain. Who knew what living things might do? Where there had been many voices, many wills, now there was but one. With the Logos he had sown, and now with the Logos he would reap. "Soon, father. I will see you soon." Turning from Esmanet, Kellis held out his radiant hands, and a hush passed through the vast congregation. Earlier, he had sent messengers announcing a final council of great and lesser names on the slopes above the teeming encampment. As he had expected, far more than the caste nobility had answered his call. Fairly half the holy war had massed on the incline before him, clotting the summit, perched like crows along the rims of those ruined sepulchres near enough to afford a view. He stood partway down the slope so that, for those above, Shima would rise like a halo about his head and shoulders. The lords of the holy war occupied an oblong clearing immediately before him, sitting in the grass. Their look was at once eager and chaste, brimming with enthusiasm, yet wary of the cauldron to come. To their right, forming a south shore for the sea of faces rising behind them, the Nascenti stood stiff with uncertain pride, doing their best to convey the impression that they alone knew what was about to happen. Eleazarus, Iacus, and several other scarlet schoolmen stood on the opposite shore, their faces blank with anxiousness. Kellis saw Eleazarus lean to listen to the bandaged Iacus. The Grand Master's gaze momentarily clicked to a Kamian who stood, as usual, on Kellis's left.
"I turn," Kellis cried, "and I see you in your thousands, the Holy War, the great tribe of truth. But I also see thousands upon thousands more, assembled in gleaming ranks, filling the plains, the distant slopes. I see the ghosts of the fallen standing among us, watching with pride those who will make good their heart-breaking sacrifice."
There could be no forgetting. They had paid for this moment in terror and blood.
"Those who will reclaim my brother's house."
He could remember, perfectly, what it had been like those 3 years past, stepping from the shadow of Ishual's fallow gate. Countless tracks had fanned out from his feet, leading to countless possible outcomes. But unlike a tree, he could war only in one direction. With every step, he murdered alternatives, collapsed future after future, walking a line too thin to be marked on any map. For so long, he had believed that line, that track, belonged to him, as though his every footfall had been a monstrous decision for which he alone could be called to account. Step after step, annihilating world after possible world, warring until only this moment survived. But those futures he now knew had been murdered long before. The ground he traveled had been conditioned through and through. At every turn, the probabilities had been summed, the possibilities averaged, the forks impossibly predetermined. Even here, standing before Shima, he executed but one operation in the skein of another's godlike calculation. Even here, his every decision, his every act, confirmed the dread intent of the thousandfold thought.
30 years.
A soft-eyed grin.
I'm reminded of our first council, he said, so very long ago on the Andiamine Heights.
They smiled at his rueful scowl.
I recall that we were fat.
Laughter, at once thunderous and intimate, as though they were dozens instead of thousands, listening to a beloved uncle tell well-worn jokes. He was their axle, and they were his wheel.
Proyas, he called, grinning like a father at a son's beloved foibles. I remember you were bent upon winning your contest with Icuri's Arias. You mourned the straits that forced you time and again to sacrifice principle for convenience, scripture for politics. For your entire life, you sought a purity you thought you could glimpse but could never grasp. For your entire life, you yearned for a bold god, not one who skulked in scriptoriums, whispering the inaudible to the insane.
Now you rail at the old habits and mourn the toll of the new. He looked to the Earl of Agansinor, who sat like a youth, his knees held in the burly circle of his arms.
Gothyelk, you wished only to die absolved. The water of your life was running dry, and it seemed all you could taste was the salt of your sins. What old caste warrior doesn't turn to counting his crimes? And you, looking back on your life, decided that the hoard was too great, that only your blood could tip the scales of redemption.
Now, thinking my finger on the balance, you dare dream of a quiet death.
And Gotian, sweet Gotian, you desired only to be told, not out of some base desire to grovel at the feet of another, but to shape your life into the very mold of God's will. Despite your power and prestige, you were forever haunted by your ignorance. You could not, like so many others, take comfort in the pretense of knowledge.
I have become your rule and revelation, the very incarnation of the certainty you seek. This exercise had become a custom of his. By calling out the truth of a few faces, he made them all feel known, watched.
Each of you, he continued, sweeping his gaze across the assembly, had your reasons for joining the holy war. Some of you came to conquer, some to atone, some to boast, to avenge, to flee. But I wonder, can any one of you say that you came for Shima alone?
For several moments he heard nothing but the discordant hammering of their hearts. It was as though their breasts had become 10,000 drums.
Is there no one?
What he wrought here had to be perfect. There had been no mistaking the words of the old man who had accosted him in Gim. The sails of the Mandate fleet could appear any day now, and the Gnostic schoolmen would not yield their war lightly. Everything had to be complete before their arrival. Everything had to be inevitable. If they had no hand in the work that they witnessed, they would be that much more reluctant in advancing their claims.
Your father bids me tell you, the blind hermit had said, there is but one tree in Kaiodia.
The question was whether the men of the Tusk could prevail without him.
None of you!
He cried in a voice like a crossbow bolt.
None of you came simply for Shima, because you're men, and the hearts of men are not simple.
He looked from face to face, inviting them to see the obvious.
Our passions are a morass. And because we lack the words to name them, we pretend our words are the only true passions. We make our impoverished schemes the measure. We condemn the complicated and cheer the caricature. What man does not yearn for a simple soul, to love without recrimination, to act without hesitation, to lead without reservation?
He saw the recognition sparking in 1,000 eyes.
But there is no such soul.
To speak was to pluck the lute strings of another soul. To intone was to strum full chords. He had long ago learned how to speak past meanings, to mind passion with mere voice.
Conflict is what we are in truth. Conflict. We think it an affliction, an obstruction, an adversary to be overcome, when in fact it is the very quintessence of our souls. Think back on your life. Have any of your motives been pure? Ever? Or is this one more lie you use to appease your gluttonous vanity? Think! Is there anything you've done for the love of God alone?
Again, silence, both shamefaced and willing.
No, there's nothing simple in your hearts. Even the adoration you bear me is marbled with fear, avarice, doubt. Where Jao worries he's lost my favor because I've laid eyes upon Gayamakri thrice. Gotian despairs, for he's aspired to purity his entire life.
A smattering of laughter.
The shadows of conflict darken all of your faces. Conflict! Does this mean that you're impure, wicked, or unworthy?
The final word rang like an accusation.
Or does it mean that you are men?
A wind had dropped into the silence, and the scent of the onlookers filled his nostrils. The bitter of rotting teeth, the ink of armpits, the honey of unwashed anuses, all shot through with strands of balsam, orange, and jasmine. And for a moment it seemed he stood within a great circle of apes, hunched and unwashed, watching him with dark and dumbfounded eyes. Then he glimpsed another circle, this one far different, where the men of the Tusk stood as they stood now, only with their backs turned to him so that they looked outward, while he occupied the shadowy heart of them all, unseen, unguessed. He knew their incantations, the words that could burn them, that could bring down their cyclopean walls. But more importantly, he knew the words that could wield them, that spoke from the darkness that came before. He need only speak to make men blubber, to make them cut their own throats. What did it mean to make instruments of men? And what did it matter, so long as they were wielded in the name of the God? There was only mission.
There's nothing deeper, he said with a sudden apologetic melancholy. There's no undiscovered purity lying obscured in our souls. We are legion, both within and without. Even our God is a God of warring gods. We are conflict, to our very pith. We are war.
Towering above the heads of his wild countrymen, the giant Yalgrota, his hair crazed in the humidity, raised his blood-stained axe and howled. Within moments, the air shivered with cries, and brandished weapons dazzled the hillside with reflected sunlight. Everywhere Kellis looked, he saw honed edges and clenched teeth, beating fists and rolling eyes. Even Esmanette daubed tears from the coal about her eyes. Only Akamian stood apart from the spectacle.
The Book of Songs, Kellis continued, tells us that war is heart without harness. Or think of Protathus, who says that war is where the gag of the small is cut away. Why do you think the only true simplicity we ever find, the only peace, is on the field of battle? The blow fended, the blow struck, the howling chorus, the bestial dance, the pendulum of horror and exultation. Can't you see? War is our soul made manifest. In it we are called out and condensed, and we burn so very bright.
He held the holy war in the palm of his intent. The Orthodox had all but dissolved in the face of his manifest divinity. As his intricati, Esmanette had effectively silenced the remaining dissenters. Both Confess and the Skilvendi had been removed from the plate. Only Akamian yet dared look at him in alarm.
Tomorrow you shall descend upon the last of a wicked people. Tomorrow you shall wrest my brother's house from their depraved fury.
he looked directly to Nersay Proyas. Tomorrow, you shall raise arms to Shima, and I, the prophet of war, shall be your prize. For months now, he had trained them, teaching them cues that they recognized without realizing, when to speak and when to hush, when to cry out and when to cease breathing.
But most blessed,
Proyas exclaimed, using one of the many honorifics that he and others had devised.
You speak as though...
A guileless frown.
Are you not leading the morning assault?
Kellis smiled as though caught with holding a glorious secret.
Every brother is a son, and every son must first visit my father's house.
Again the look from Akamian. Again the need to subdue the man's endless misgivings. Gathered on the slopes above the encampment, the lords of the holy war unanimously agreed they must assault the city, starving the sacred city to force her defenders, both arcane and mundane, to battle outside the walls wasn't an option. The Enrithi no longer possessed the numbers to effectively surround Shima. Any determined heathen sortie they knew could win their way through. And even though Shima's harbor was silted in due to the neglect of her Kianine masters, supplies still could arrive by sea. The only points of contention turned on the warrior prophet's demand that they attack the city on the morrow, and the dismaying revelation that they must do so without him. Of the latter, he refused to speak, but of the former, he said, "We attack a foe still reeling from disaster, a foe who are many, but now that we've arrived, think on your experience. In the face of enemies, time welds the hearts of men, certainty, righteousness. These things strike first." The previous day, outriders had scoured the surrounding hills, searching for any sign of Fenial and the reassembled Fenim host. The Amati, as a rule, knew nothing, and those Kianine they captured told tales of varying outlandishness. Kinganjahoy, the tiger of Umarna, waited in the Betmula, ready to descend upon them at any moment. Or the Kianine fleet, which supposedly had been destroyed, had stormed the Zarashi coast, disgorging an army that even now approached from their rear. Or Fenial had commanded a mass exodus, and even now retreated with the Kishorim to the great city of Selukara. Or all the strength of Kian lay coiled in Shima like a snake in a basket, poised to strike the instant the Enrithi raised the lid. No matter what the tale, the idolaters were either assured victory or doomed. The consensus among the great names was that none of these tales were true. The warrior prophet disagreed, pointing out that the captives repeated the same half-dozen stories. "Fenial has planted these rumors," he said. "He makes noise to obscure truth's call." He admonished them to remember the man who strove against them. "Don't forget his daring on the fields of Mengeda and Anwarat. Fenial may be the son of Kaskamandri," he said, "but he's a student of Scaurus." The decision was made to confine their assault to Shima's westward walls, not only because the encampment lay to the west of the city, but because the Jutarum lay on the west bank of the Jeshimal, and everyone agreed that the sacred heights must be their first objective. So long as the Kishorim remained undefeated, they knew, all was jeopardy. Proyas and Gotian then petitioned the Blessed One, begging to lead the assault in advance of the Scarlet Spires. Though the Tusk's condemnation of sorcery had been rescinded, they still loathed the thought of sorcerers being the first to set foot in the sacred city. But Kinjoza and Gothyelk vehemently disagreed.
"I've lost one son to Scarlet Sloth,"
the old Tidoni Earl exclaimed, referring to the death of his youngest in Karaskand.
"I shall not lose another."
But as always, the warrior prophet decided the issue. "We, all of us, will attack together," he said. "Who attacks first, who stands where in the order of battle, these things mean nothing. Surely, after so much suffering, success can be our only point of honor. Success!" Meanwhile, the men of the Tusk occupied themselves with preparations, threw themselves at their tasks with sweat and song. Parties were set into the hills for timber, though not much was required. Raiders were dispatched down the Amati coast, ordered to secure what supplies they could. Knights wove mantlets from olive branches. For miles, surrounding groves were stripped to their gnarled trunks. Haphazard ladders were constructed of poplars and palm. Great stones were gathered from the shoreline to be used as ammunition. The siege engines built at Garotha, which the warrior prophet had ordered disassembled and borne by Zarashi captives in the host's train, were brought forward and rebuilt, some even in darkness. Late that night, as they stretched their limbs before their fires, they talked long of the strangeness of it all, their words and manner somewhere between exhaustion and exultation. They traded accounts of the warrior prophet's words at the Council of Great and Lesser Names, and though they took heart, many men of the Tusk found their haste troubling, as though they, like the inconstant and the irresolute, had lost heart at the moment of consummation, and sought only to bring the ordeal to a swift conclusion. And as the fires went out, leaving only the most stubborn and thoughtful awake, the skeptics dared argue their misgivings. "But think," the faithful retorted, "when we die surrounded by the spoils of a long and daring life, we will look up to those who adore us and we will say, 'I knew him. I knew the warrior prophet.'"